At the height of her Hollywood career, Hedy Lamarr was known as the most beautiful woman in the world. And for most of her life, her legacy was her looks. But a 1941 news article revealed one of her hobbies.
Hollywood, California, September 30th. Hedy Lamarr, screen actress, was revealed today in a new role, that of an inventor. So vital is her discovery to national defense that government officials will not allow publication of its details.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Rhodes, reading from his new book about Lamarr called Hedy's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr. That discovery the article mentioned? A landmark invention in wireless communication that paved the way for a lot of technology we use today, like GPS and Bluetooth. Rhodes says Lamarr always loved science, but spent most of her early adult life trying to escape an unhappy marriage to an Austrian arms dealer.
He gave her jewels, he gave her gold, he gave her everything she could possibly want, except her freedom.
When World War II started, Hedy's husband began manufacturing weapons for the Germans. When Nazi generals visited their home, the conversations focused on weapons, and Hedy listened in.
With Hedy sitting at the dinner table, hardly anyone ever speaking to her, but she's smart and she's interested in technology and she listens as she begins to think, how can I escape this domineering, paranoid husband of mine?
So, Richard Rhodes, eventually Hedy does escape. She leaves her husband, right?
She escapes, not quite as dramatically as she always told the story. She really didn't dress up as one of her maids, drug the maid, put the maid in her clothes, and jump out the window.
There it's a was, little in fact, artistic yes, license in the retelling of that.
It made a good story. There was, in fact, a divorce proceeding underway in Vienna. She heard that mayor of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer was scouting for actors and actresses. She went to see him in London. He wasn't willing to offer her a very good deal. She said no and walked out, having great confidence in herself. Found out that he was going to sail back to the United States and bought passage. And once she was aboard, she found a way to make him long for her, let's say. After all, she was an actress. And before the ship landed in New York, she had a much, much better contract, the equivalent of about $3,000 a week for 7 years. And within a year, with the appearance of her in the film Algiers, opposite Charles Boyer, she was a superstar.
So let's talk about that. She does become a big star. She becomes an icon. At what point does this start to lose interest for her? At what point does she return to thinking about science and invention?
Well, there were two converging events here. One is people who made movies in those days typically only made maybe 3 movies a year. So they had a lot of downtime. And Hedy didn't drink. She didn't like to party. Her idea of a good evening was a quiet dinner party with some intelligent friends where they could discuss ideas, which sounds so un-Hollywood. But Hedy had to find something else to do to occupy her time. And she took up inventing. And she invented, for example, with a little help from Howard Hughes, one of her boyfriends, she invented a little tablet that if you dropped in a glass of water would dissolve and produce a Coca-Cola, if you will. She laughed later and said, well, it never really worked. But
yeah, what did it taste like?
Probably tastes like an Alka-Seltzer tablet, which is basically what it was. But she was constantly looking at the world and thinking, well, how could that be fixed? How could that be improved? The other part of her coming to this important invention in her life was that she was keenly aware of the coming war. She was glued to the newspaper reading the stories about what was going on, and particularly when German submarines began torpedoing passenger liners, she felt at that point, I've got to invent something that will put a stop to that.
So explain what she actually invented.
She thought if a torpedo could be radio-guided, you could be much more sure that that it would take that ship or submarine out. But she understood that the problem with radio signals is that they can be jammed. The idea that she came up with was if you can make the signal hop around more or less randomly from radio frequency to radio frequency, then the person at the other and trying to jam the signal won't know where it is. If they try to jam one particular frequency, it might hit that frequency on one of its hops, but it would only be there for a fraction of a second.
I'm speaking with Richard Rhodes about his new book. It's called Hedy's Folly, telling the story of Hedy Lamarr, the silver screen bombshell, who was also an inventor. So what happened to her idea?
So she submitted it to the National Inventors Council. They liked the idea a lot. Hedy and her companion in invention worked together and got a patent for what was called a secret communication system, which was just this frequency hopping idea. And they gave the patent free of charge to the United States Navy. And the Navy being the Navy, if it hadn't been able to make a torpedo that worked, obviously it wasn't going to be receptive to ideas coming in from the outside. Mm. And the Navy basically threw it into the file.
And was it ever to be revived?
So, after the war, the Navy was interested in developing a buoy that would sit in the water and, using sonar, detect possible submarine activity below it. And then they needed a jam-proof signal to go from the buoy to the airplane overhead that was receiving the information. And they resuscitated the idea of frequency hopping and built it into the sonobuoy. And after that, the whole system just spread like wildfire. The most well-known application today is Bluetooth.
So you're saying if Hedy Lamarr was responsible for the technology that ended up giving us Bluetooth wireless technology today, why isn't she credited for that?
The patent itself had expired. During most of its life, it had been a military secret. By the time it came out, it had been permutated through all of these Navy technologies developed by other companies at other places at other times, and she was simply lost in the noise. However, in the 1990s, when Hedy was in her early 80s, one of the pioneers of wireless communications for computers came across all this information and realized that Hedy had never been honored for her invention, and started the ball rolling so that one of the major communications organizations would give her one of its annual awards. When they called her up to tell her that she would get the award, her first words were, Hedy Lamarr being Hedy Lamarr, well, it's about time. But she, I'm sure, was delighted that finally she did receive some recognition for her invention.
Richard Rhodes is the author of Hedy's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr. He joined us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Richard Rhodes, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
P.D. James pretty much epitomizes the term living legend among mystery writers. At 91, she's the author of 20 books. In recognition of her great contributions to mystery literature, James, who was from a middle-class background, was given the title Baroness James of Holland Park in 1991. Now James has decided to pay tribute to a writer whose works have stayed with her throughout her long life. James's latest novel is called Death Comes to Pemberley, and it's a sequel to Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
During the 50-plus years that Agatha Christie actively reigned as the Queen of Crime, it became something of a tradition in England to give one of her novels as a holiday present. In fact, she and her publishers popularized the slogan, A Christie for Christmas. Dame Agatha died in 1976, but the association of Murder Most Foul and the Yuletide season lingers. This year, British mystery lovers in particular have a glorious plum pudding of a whodunit awaiting them. P.D. James has taken up the challenge of feeding readers holiday hunger for homicide. What's even more tantalizing is the fact that James's latest mystery is also a tribute of sorts to one of her most cherished authors, Jane Austen. James's new novel is called Death Comes to Pemberley. Think Pride and Prejudice meets Clue. To enjoy this mystery, which I did enormously, you must take it on its own terms. Death Comes to Pemberley is a sequel to Pride and Prejudice, written in the spirit of what Graham Greene famously called an entertainment. James is having fun in her own intelligent, literate way, and this novel is an invitation to her readers to join in the revels. In so many ways, James and Austin are suspense sisters under the skin. Money, one of Austin's chief themes, certainly lies at the heart of many a crime in James's mysteries. Another commonality is that James's writing style has always had something of the 18th century about it. Think of all that formal, balanced poetry her detective, Adam Dalgliesh, cranks out. Naturally, then, James is adept at spinning out those skewering epigrams we associate with Austin. You'll recall the immortal first line of Pride and Prejudice. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. Well, James is much too wise to go toe-to-toe with Austin on that line, but she does produce some gentle enlightenment zingers of her own. Speaking of the odious Mr. Collins, the narrator here tells us that his canny wife, Charlotte, consistently congratulated him on qualities he did not possess, in the hope that, flattered by her praise and approval, he would acquire them. There's something even more profound, however, that James brings to her reading of Austin. In Death Comes to Pemberley, she ferrets out the alternative noir tales that lurk in the corners of Pride and Prejudice, commonly thought of as Austin's sunniest novel. Ruinous matches, early deaths, the Napoleonic Wars, socially enforced female vulnerability, Austin keeps these shadows at bay, while James noses deep into them. Death Comes to Pemberley takes place 6 years after Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy have wed. Lizzie has dutifully produced an heir and a spare, and seems at first to have lost her girlish sass and sparkle. But marriage does tend to drain life out of our intrepid literary heroines. Consider Jo March or Bella Swan. On a dark and stormy night before the annual Great Ball at Pemberley, a carriage careens up the drive and out stumbles Elizabeth's ne'er-do-well sister, Lydia, shrieking hysterically about her missing husband, Wickham. The men of the manor launch a search party, and later that night, in the middle of some blasted woods, Wickham is spotted, spattered with blood, and bending over the body of... But I won't let the identity of that corpse out of the cupboard. As Austin did in her elegant spoof, Northanger Abbey, James clearly enjoys muddying her wellies here in the gothic literary terrain of ghosts and ancestral mansions and curses. Throughout the mystery that unfolds, she ingeniously works in characters and themes, great and small, from Pride and Prejudice, and also gives erudite nods to the history of forensics and jury trials in Great Britain. I cautioned earlier that Death Comes to Pemberley should be read in the spirit of an entertainment, but certainly even entertainments have the power to be moving. James has said in interviews that crime fiction and the novels of Jane Austen have been two of her life's abiding passions. To think of P.D. James at age 91 so successfully uniting those passions between the covers of one book is a thought to warm a reader's heart in the dead of winter.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Death Comes to Pemberley by P.D. James. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.
Republican presidential candidate Michelle Bachmann hopes for another climb on the roller coaster. The Minnesota congresswoman led many polls last summer. Now she's fallen behind as the first voting nears in Iowa.
This week she released a book called Core of Conviction. When we sat down to talk about it, Bachmann spoke of raising children, those born to her, and many foster kids.
I had a newborn, a 2-year-old, a 4-year-old. I had one that was in first grade. I had a 7th grader who was kind of lippy at the time. That's my biological son. And then we had our foster children. And we had every age range. I have a doctorate degree and a postdoctorate degree in federal tax law. And I will tell you, this is the most intellectually challenging experience I've ever had in my life.
With stories like that, Bachman hopes to give a more rounded view of herself.
She rose to national attention with fierce rhetoric. During last summer's battle over the federal debt ceiling, Bachman opposed raising it, and she dismissed warnings of financial disaster.
Her rhetoric also caused her trouble. For example, Bachman said on TV that a vaccine was harmful to children. The fact-checking website PolitiFact.com rated her statements false.
PolitiFact also questioned her statements in a debate this week. And it was after that debate that we met with the candidate who has worked to represent the Tea Party movement against larger government. Her book suggests the complexity of her story. She spent years on government payrolls as a tax lawyer, running a charter school, and as a politician.
I'm not anti-government, that we shouldn't have government. It's that I believe that government can be run more efficiently. It can do more with a lot less money. And there's also things that government does that they have no business doing.
You began by saying you're not anti-government. You want to fix
how
it works.
That's right.
Is there something about your rhetoric or the rhetoric of many people in the conservative movement that have given the impression that people are anti-government?
Well, I suppose you'd have to ask the people who listen to what my rhetoric is or what other people's rhetoric is, if they feel that it's anti-government or not. My whole goal is to make things better and to fix things. But in my book, what I talk about is what it is that motivates me. What is the 3D aspect of Michelle Bachman that is my core? And my core of conviction is centered around the animating principles that created America. One of those is that no one owes you a living.
You write in your book, I'm paraphrasing here, that you think it's really important in political debate to get your facts right. But you acknowledge that sometimes you've come up a little
bit short. Oh, absolutely. I wish I was perfection on walking on air, but I'm not. I've gotten things wrong. But I try very hard to get my facts right. And there's times when I've said things that are inaccurate, and I regret that. But the good thing about this process, let me say this, it's a good training ground to become better. And I'm grateful for that opportunity.
Let's stipulate that everybody makes mistakes when they speak and has to correct them sometimes later on. But I'm wondering, when you're in these moments, in speeches or in debates, what was going through your mind? Were you trying really hard to draw a bright contrast with your opponents and the rhetoric just went a little too far?
I'm happy to say I don't think that I've said anything inaccurate in any of the debates, and I'm extremely grateful for that. It's a high-profile stage, and so I'm grateful that I don't think that I've made a blunder.
I have a piece of tape, if you don't mind me playing this.
Go ahead.
In the debate on foreign policy the other day on CNN, there was an exchange, a really interesting one, between Newt Gingrich and you. It involved other candidates as we went along. But the former House Speaker made a statement about immigration, which he intended to be a rather nuanced statement about perhaps allowing some legal way for some currently illegal immigrants to stay. You responded by saying, I don't agree with letting 11 million illegal people becoming legal. And Speaker Gingrich responded that that's not what he meant at all. Let's listen to that exchange.
I specifically did not say we'd make the 11 million people legal. I do suggest if you go back to your district and you find people who've been here 25 years and have two generations of family and have been paying taxes and are in a local church, as somebody who believes strongly in family, you're going to have a hard time explaining why that particular subset is being broken up and forced to leave, given the fact that they've been law-abiding citizens for 25 years.
Congresswoman Bachman, you want to respond?
If I understood correctly, I think the speaker just said that that would make 11 million people who are here illegally now legal. That's really the issue that we're dealing with.
Now, in fairness, Congresswoman Bachman, I'm not exactly sure what Newt Gingrich meant by that statement, but I'm pretty sure he did not say, let's legalize 11 million illegals today. Why did you say that he just had said that?
Because he's on record saying that. He's on record saying that he believes that the 11 million workers, illegal workers that are in the United States today should be made legal. Of all of the candidates that are on the stage, he is the farthest in being in the amnesty camp. He doesn't call it amnesty, but he said that he is open to having the 11 million workers in the country be made legal overnight. He's not talking about only people who've been here for 25 years. He's talking about all workers that are here in the United States illegally. There is no other candidate on the stage that is willing to make illegal workers legal. There's no other candidate on the stage willing to be for the Federal Dream Act other than former Speaker Gingrich.
But did you make the difference more dramatic than it is? I mean, are there really only two positions here? Either you're with your position or you're in favor of legalizing 11 million people right away?
Well, again, I'm going from the speaker's statement that he made prior to last night on the stage. The statement that he made in another forum is that he would be willing to make 11 million illegal workers legal.
Give me an idea, as someone who has seen this from the seat on the roller coaster, how it is you think you rose so quickly in the polls over the summer and how it is that you think you've slid back again.
Well, I think that wouldn't be just me. I think that's a lot of the candidates in the race.
It's like
it's a political Wall Street. You know, if you look at how stocks go up and down, it's the same thing with politics. One thing people know about me is that I'm authentic and sincere. So I'm not pulling anyone's leg when I'm out campaigning. What I say is what I mean. I think that's allowed me to win in Minnesota and in Iowa, and we have a great deal of support. And so people, I think, are going to be shocked on January 3rd. We're working very hard, and I'm aiming to win. I'm aiming to defeat Barack Obama, not only in the general, but to be the Republican nominee. And we see a clear pathway to victory.
Would you be able to govern?
Of course. Absolutely, I could govern. Without a shadow of a doubt, I can govern.
And I'm not asking about your experience here, competence, or anything else. I'm asking specifically about the way that you've staked out very strong political positions.
Of course I can, because this is what I will do as the Republican nominee. I won't rest without helping to elect 13 more like-minded Republican U.S. senators. That would get us to a 60-seat filibuster-proof majority, and that will allow us to be able to repeal Obamacare, repeal Dodd-Frank. I've written the legislation to do both of those, and to be able to change the tax code.
So if somebody says, how do you compromise? How do you do the muddy, ugly work of passing bills? Your answer is, I'm not going to have to compromise. I'm going to win so big.
No, that's not true at all, because there's compromises you need to make within your own political party as well. You don't stay married for 33 years and not compromise. You don't raise 29 children without compromising. You don't build a successful company without compromising. You don't lead a massive education reform movement in my state without compromising. And you don't bring people together the way I did here in Washington to actively work to defeat Obamacare.
But help me here.
I don't compromise principle. Well, that's the difference.
Help me here. If let's say you become president of the United States, you win the election in 2012, but Republicans, for whatever reason, don't get 60 votes in the Senate, which is what it's required to pass something in the Senate these days without any help from the other party. Would your answer then be, well, okay, two more years of gridlock?
I don't want gridlock. My attempt is to move forward. One thing I'm able to do is take a complex subject and break it down and speak about it plainly so people understand it. I intend to use that office of the presidency to be able to speak directly into the hearts of the American people about why we need to move legislation, because this is a tsunami election, in my opinion. If you look at the polls, the one who really needs to worry is Barack Obama.
Michelle Bachmann is a Minnesota member of Congress, Republican presidential candidate, and author of the new book, Core of Conviction, My Story. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Three years ago, author and screenwriter Michael Crichton died of cancer, leaving behind a partially written manuscript. When Crichton's family decided to publish that manuscript posthumously, they turned to fiction and science writer Richard Preston to help. Preston got the first part of the book that would be named Micro, and a handful of Crichton's notebooks filled with handwritten scrawls.
And then there were lists of things. For example, a list of the kinds of creatures that might be threatening. Ants, birds, termites, ? And then he remarked, there are no termites in Hawaii.
Richard Preston spoke to us from studios in Princeton, New Jersey. The lists, he says, were a guideline for him to flesh out the story of a group of promising young science researchers who are lured into working for a mysterious technology firm.
These students end up in Hawaii with this technology firm run by a guy who turns out to be a total sociopath. And he has a giant machine that will shrink objects down to a fraction of their former size, including living organisms, including humans. So these seven students get shrunk down to about 1/2 inch tall. They become microhumans, and then they end up abandoned in the rainforest of Oahu, and they have to somehow find their way home. It's a story that has a kind of an odyssey quality to it. And what happens to them after they get into the rainforest is they begin encountering micro monsters. And you can think of creatures the size of Tyrannosaurus rex that are armored and equipped with shearing mandibles and chemical weapons. So we're talking about pretty serious challenges here.
And, of course, these creatures you're describing are ants, birds, owls, all kinds of grubs. I mean, they're insects, basically.
Yes, and to us they seem somewhat harmless. But Michael Crichton had this marvelous insight into the natural world, which is that we human beings are actually giants on the scale of size in nature. We are more akin to blue whales and redwood trees than we are to most forms of life on the planet, which are much, much smaller than we are. So, you know, I went around and I did a lot of research. Michael was scrupulous about his scientific research. And the species that appear in Micro are all the real thing. And I also took care to set them accurately in their ecosystem. So, for example, we have, I don't want to give too much away here, but we have an appearance of bats in the story. It's the Hawaiian hoary bat. Now, to a micro human, a hoary bat is about the size of a Boeing 757 jet. And it's armed with a jaw, fangs, that look eerily like those of a lion. And it also is equipped with ultrasonic sonar, which it uses to identify prey.
And all of this sounds, this is all as horrifying as it comes off in the book when you get to these scenes. It's scary.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Michael Crichton, he dispatches a number of characters in this story in wonderfully Crichton-esque grisly fashion, which is something that I like to do in my own writing. When I was working on one of my books, I think it might have been Demon in the Freezer, that's about smallpox. And I was working with my editor, and at one point she put her hands on her head and she said, "Oh, Richard, you're just a 14-year-old boy who likes to gross out the girls." I think Michael Crichton had something of that in him, too.
One difference that I see sort of in reading the criticism of your work and Michael Crichton is that you're praised for humanizing scientists in your fiction and nonfiction. Critics of Crichton often said he did the opposite. And this book does follow the model of Crichton works in that you have a kind of mad scientist figure.
Mad scientists are so great for drama about science. The thing about scientific disasters is that you have to be extremely intelligent to create a true scientific horror. I think that's what attracted Michael dramatically to the mad scientist theme. And also, I think our world shares a sense of skepticism and even fear of science because science often brings us a double-edged sword. Let me put it this way. It seems to me that when a really true advance comes along, like biotechnology, for example, that biotechnology can be used as medicine to save human lives, but these very same technologies can also be used for the creation of biological weapons to extinguish lives in a highly efficient way. So essentially, science becomes a reflection of the dual nature of the human soul. And when science is misused in terrible ways, it's not the fault of nature, it's the fault of ourselves.
Do you think that is Crichton's legacy, in a way, when it comes to science writing, shining a light on that duality?
I think at heart, Michael Crichton was an optimist, actually. I think he was absolutely in love with science and technology, and he yearned, as I do, to explain its wonders to regular people. For Micro, the real wonders is not the science itself, but it's the spectacle of nature seen on a different scale. The beauty of the micro world is just, it's incomparable.
Author Richard Preston co-wrote the new novel Micro, out now, completed for author Michael Crichton, who died in 2008 at age 66. Richard Preston joined us from studios in Princeton, New Jersey. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
It's time now for our regular feature for young listeners, NPR's Backseat Book Club. Every month, we choose a book and ask kids to read it, then to send in their questions for the author.
This is Phoebe Abuzizi. My favorite character was the green-eyed, curly-haired, big-foot, broad shoulders, round body, extremely enormous monster. Have you met anyone like this lately? Bye.
That's one of many questions we received about our book club selection for November. It's a classic celebrating a big anniversary, The Phantom Tollbooth, written by Norton Juster and illustrated by Jules Pfeiffer, was published 50 years ago. NPR's Michelle Norris recently talked with Juster, who says the story sprang from his own childhood.
It was about a little boy, about 9 or 10 years old, who didn't much like school, didn't see the point of learning, didn't like doing much of anything. And, of course, that was me.
The little boy in the story is named Milo. He lives in a state of constant boredom until one day a toll booth magically appears in his bedroom with a map and a series of strange instructions. Milo dusts off an old toy car and drives through the toll booth to the lands beyond. He has the adventure of a lifetime. He visits places like Digitopolis and Dictionopolis, and he meets people with silly habits and a very odd way of speaking.
Have you ever heard a blindfolded octopus unwrap a cellophane-covered bathtub?
The book is so chock-full of puns, riddles, and wordplay that publishers at first didn't think it was appropriate for kids.
And so they said, well, this is not a children's book, firstly. The vocabulary is too difficult. The issues and ideas are much too complex. The kids will never get the jokes and wordplay.
Oh, but they did. And Juster knew they would because he grew up with a father who loved linguistic absurdity.
I would come in sometimes and he would be sitting there and he would look at me and very seriously say, aha, I see you're coming early since lately. You used to be behind before, but now you're first at last. I had no idea what he was talking about, of course. And the reaction of most kids to stuff like that is just, Then he'd see I didn't know what he was talking about, so he'd come over, put his arm around me, and say, you're a good kid, and I'd like to see you get ahead. You need one. And after a while, the uhs dropped away, and I began to say, I understand that, and I can do that. And that was a great liberating part of my life.
Was this book in some way a tip of the hat to your dad?
In many ways. Yeah, the two most important influences on it were he and the Marx Brothers, because when I grew up in the 1930s, all those Marx Brothers movies were coming out. And they were, of course, absolutely insane until you saw them two or three times and realized that their particular kind of insanity made as much sense as thinking about it in very realistic terms.
Take a listen to the stage production of The Phantom Toll Booth, and you can hear the influence of the Marx Brothers as Milo receives a hearty welcome by advisors to the King of Dictionopolis.
Are you the one who was calling for the king?
Soliciting the sovereign?
Soliciting the potentate?
Said that. No, exactly.
Haranguing his highness?
I guess so.
Well, in that case, greetings.
Salutations.
Good afternoon.
By order of King Azaz,
we welcome you
to our country.
Nation.
Land. Realm.
Don't all of those words mean the exact same thing?
Certainly. Precisely.
Exactly.
Indubitably.
The Phantom Toll Booth was an indubitable success because the book so perfectly blends word and picture. The illustrations by the renowned cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer don't just adorn the text, they're an essential part of the story. And it turns out there's quite a story behind the partnership between Norton Juster and Jules Pfeiffer.
So one of those marvelous accidents of life. I was in the Navy at that time, and I was just the last place I was going to be stationed was in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And we just ran into each other. I think Jules describes it as each of us putting out garbage one day. And in about a year or two, we took a large duplex apartment, the two of us and another friend of ours, at the other end of Brooklyn Heights. I lived on the top floor, mainly because the kitchen was there and I did most of the cooking. Those two lived on the floor below. And when I wrote, I paced. And the pacing, I guess, kind of got on their nerves. So Jules came up, wanted to know what I was doing, and read some of the stuff, and he liked it, went away without my knowing it, and produced a whole bunch of absolutely wonderful drawings. And to this day, I cannot see that book any other way. That book, those illustrations, belong together and will never change.
We have a letter from one of our young readers who has a special appreciation for the illustrations. Her name is Olivia. Let's listen to her.
Hi, my name is Olivia Hughes. I'm 10 years old, and I'm from Richardson, Texas. I thought that the map at the beginning was really resourceful, and I was wondering if the illustrator worked on it alone after reading the story, or if the author worked on it with the illustrator.
Olivia has a future in journalism.
Yes, I was going
to say. Well, let's talk about the map, because it really is wonderful. When you open up the book, before you get to the story, there is this fantastic map of the lands beyond.
First of all, I wanted to have map end papers because in my early reading as a child, the books that had map end papers I loved, the Arthur Ransom books. And I was talking to Jules about it, and Jules is very funny. There are certain things he either doesn't like, to draw or doesn't think he can draw. And one of them was maps. And he said, I'm not going near a map. And actually, if you've ever driven anywhere with Jules, you will know why he doesn't like maps. But anyway, I sat down and I drew the map. And then Jules took it and traced over it so it looked like his drawing.
Many of our young readers were really interested in your life as a child, including a young girl named Emma.
Hi, my name is Emma from Springfield, Virginia, and I'm 12 years old. My brother and sister and I love to make up stories together. Did you ever do that when you were younger?
Just all the time. I lived for stories. And I would also, one thing I did as a kid I loved doing was writing little plays or playlets. And, of course, I would then draft the entire family who had to play all these parts while I was the director. But, stories are a very important part of my life. I don't think even to this day, I don't think I can deal with important world issues or issues relating to me as an adult without sometimes recasting them as stories.
You still do that today?
Oh, yes.
After 50 years, Norton Juster is still flummoxed as to why his book is such a success. But in terms of children's literary tastes, he offers this.
What children understand, when they read a story, they understand it and they'll tell you about it. It may not be what I had in mind, but it's what they have in mind. And that's the important thing. And we tend in our teaching and sometimes in our writing as if our job is to communicate a finite idea or a finite, point of view. And I think the idea, rather, is to open up a piece of the world to a more creative encounter.
Well, I think we had many, many children share with us what they thought of this book. And I think with all of those questions that were sent in to us and to you specifically, what we heard was a huge thank you for
thank
the joy
you.
And the wisdom in this book. And thank you for taking time to talk to us. This has been great fun.
Thank you.
And big thanks to everyone who sent in their questions. We're thrilled that so many classrooms and families are joining NPR's Backseat Book Club. And so a bit of breaking news. We've selected our next book. It's less well-known than earlier selections, but no less special. For December, we'll be reading Breadcrumbs by Anne Ursu. It's a magical winter tale of friendship and adventure, featuring a girl named Hazel and a boy named Jack. Head to npr.org to read the first chapter and be sure to email us your questions so we can share them with the author in our next Backseat Book Club segment. Happy reading. I'm Michelle Norris.